and that sovereignty for a nation is only for the laws of Allah, and that the nation does not depend on anyone else for its security. It also commands that it is for the Muslims to appoint a just ruler, and that the affairs of the people are the ruler's primary concern. After destroying the Khilafah in 1924, these principles were swept aside, and the Western powers carved the Muslim Ummah into nation states, installing puppet regimes in order to ensure the suffocation of the people, both intellectually and politically. Saudi Arabia is one of these imperialist creations, a near-perfect illustration of the nature of the regimes in the Muslim world, and the servant-master relationship they have developed with the Western powers. Although this film focuses on the Saudi regime and its relationship with America, its aim is to make Muslims conscious of the general political circumstances surrounding them, so that all the corrupt regimes in the Muslim world are politically challenged, accounted and replaced with one Islamic state, the Khilafah. The modern-day Kingdom of Saudi Arabia came into existence as a result of a rebellion against the Islamic Khilafah state. Britain sought to strike the Islamic state from within. Followers of the Wahhabi madhab by then had managed to establish an entity within the Islamic state, led by Muhammad ibn Saud and later by his son Abdulaziz. Britain supplied them with weapons and money, and they moved on a sectarian basis to seize the Islamic lands, which were under the authority of the Khilafah. They took up arms against the Khalifa and fought the Islamic armed forces, all the time goaded by the British. It was well known that Al Saud were British agents. The huge arsenals and equipments which reached them via India, and the monies to cover the war effort against the Khilafah, were supplied by the British. They exploited the Wahhabi madhab with the aim of fighting the Islamic State and clashing with the other madhabs in order to incite sectarian wars with the Uthmani Khilafah. The followers of this madhab were unaware of this, but the Saudi Emir was fully aware. This is because the relationship was not between the British and Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab, but between the British and Al Saud. Al Saud's family reward for playing the most important role in this rebellion was to be granted by the British the position of future rulers of Hijaz. They had so much trust and confidence in their British masters and were so arrogant of their possession that they called it Saudi on September the 23rd, 1933, the only state in the world to be named after a family. Contrary to popular Western myth, it is the Saudis that are dependent on the US and not the other way round. The relationship is one in which the Saudi regime has no leverage over the US, while the US exerts almost total control over the regime with the power to remove the regime overtly or covertly. It was King Abdulaziz who invited foreigners, including a major American oil company, to facilitate exploration for assets beneath the soil of the impoverished kingdom. In May 1933, a 60-year contract offering the exclusive concession for exploration and extraction of oil was concluded with Standard Oil of California. It was not until 1938 that they first struck oil in commercial quantities. The company name would later change in 1944 to Aramco, the Arabian American Oil Company. It was totally American owned, and it would be another 30 years before the Saudis acquired a 25% share and then finally full control in 1980. The kingdom's unparalleled oil resources laid the foundations of the relationship. The United States focused on excluding other foreign powers, as the American State Department official, George Kennan, viewed the matter in 1944.
The oil in the region is the greatest single material prize in all history.
American leaders have since then concluded that their ultimate national interest in the Gulf is to keep the prize and the power that comes with it out of unfriendly hands. At the time, this meant not only the USSR, but more importantly, Britain, then a major regional power whose bases in Iraq and Jordan, both ruled by her stooges, were rivals for influence.
Leaving the train, King Faisal, wearing a cream and gold uniform, salutes the Queen with a charming gesture and receives in turn a warm family welcome.
Their proximity to the oil fields, British ambitions, and British trained military forces all led to America ensuring that the Saudis concluded a defense pact with the United States in 1951. It included lease of the Dahran airfield. When Britain formed the Baghdad Pact, which encompassed Britain, Iraq, Iran, Turkey, and Pakistan, in order to protect its interests from the Americans, the US responded by getting the Saudis to sign a mutual defense pact with its most successful agent, Gamal Abdel Nasser, and invited Egyptian military trainers into the kingdom in parallel to the Americans. A few years later, in the Suez Crisis of 1956, President Eisenhower forcefully opposed the British, French and Israeli plan to seize Egypt's Suez Canal, seeing it as a European neo-imperial enterprise. In turn, the crisis enhanced America's image in the region, allowing the Saudis to renew the American lease at Dahran the next year. Eventually, it was the Carter administration in the fall of 1978 that witnessed the most significant removal of British influence in the region in the shape of the overthrow of the Shah of Iran. Saudi oil revenues were also harnessed by America to spread capitalism in its global struggle against communism, sponsoring anti-communist rebel movements in Angola, Ethiopia and Afghanistan. However, it was often done in a secret manner, such as when the White House in May 1984, at the request of Reagan's National Security Advisor Robert McFarlane, instructed Prince Bandar to deposit over $1 million a month in a Miami bank account belonging to the American-backed Nicaraguan Contra rebels, after Congress had stopped official funding. However, Americans began to question their alliance with the Saudis after September the 11th, like never before. A number of academics, thinkers and policymakers sought to distance the relationship between Saudi and themselves. The Republican Senator Richard Shelby said,
"We have at our best not a great relationship with the Saudis. It's transactional, and we should keep that in mind."
This essentially represents the view of the neoconservatives. Although Bush had publicly distanced himself from such calls, it is clear that he quietly endorsed this view. The influential conservative think tank, the RAND Corporation, was specifically hired by Bush in 2002 to investigate Saudi Arabia and the options available to the US. They in turn branded Saudi Arabia the kernel of evil, adding that
Saudis are active at every level of the terror chain.
More so, it advocated that the US invade the country, targeting in particular Mecca and Medina, seizing its oil fields and confiscating its financial assets, something originally proposed by US officials back in the 70s. The reason why the US administration has not already severed links with Saudi is because this would not be conducive to a strategic interest. Saudi Arabia is not only the number one supplier to the United States, but the oil is sold to the US at a discount of $1 per barrel, translating into a subsidy to US consumers of $620 million per year. Saudi also represents 25% of the world's known oil supplies, and so the US would struggle to meet her domestic energy demands without their compliance. Furthermore, Bush has been criticized by oil companies for the lack of progress made in securing Iraq's oil. The popular Iraqi resistance and sabotage to pipelines has reduced the flow of oil to a trickle, exporting only a third of its capability. On the US domestic front, consumers faced with soaring gas prices at the pump blame Bush for much of America's energy woes. The Bush administration, faced with the growing tide of disapproval, asked the Saudis to come up with a plan that dramatically increases its oil production capacity. In April 2005, Crown Prince Abdullah Saudi proposed to spend $50 billion over a 5-year period to increase production capacity to 12.5 million barrels per day by 2009 from the current 11 million limit. The aim, to flood the international oil market, to reduce the oil price in order to aid the American economy, even though it would also diminish Saudi profits and significantly damage the country's economy. A sacrifice the Saudis have made for their American masters on previous occasions. Notwithstanding this, the Saudis also plan to give US energy companies a huge bonanza by inviting them to invest in Saudi Arabia's other energy sectors. Crown Prince Abdullah furthermore plans to make it easier for American businessmen to take wealth out of the country by proposing to relax the laws. Clearly, the Americans remain the primary beneficiaries of Abdullah's plan, whilst the Muslim Ummah continues to suffer. Washington's commitment to Saudi Arabia has proceeded in tandem with a close security relationship with Israel. America's connection to Israel, which grew from a generalized support in the 1940s to an arms supply relationship in the mid-1960s, should have been a source of complication for the Saudis, the self-proclaimed guardians of the Holy Land. However, apart from some rhetoric, it had little effect on ties with Washington. After all, if they could tolerate US control of the Hejaz, they could tolerate Zionist control over Palestine. because of Arab and Muslim sentiment, Saudi leaders on the face of it had to appear to be opposed to a sovereign Jewish presence in the midst of the Arab world. But the Saudis were set to play a useful part in America's plans for the region. The first meeting of Saudi and American heads of state took place in 1945 aboard an American warship on the Suez Canal. Publicly, President Franklin D. Roosevelt pledged that he personally, as a president, would never do anything which might prove hostile to the Arabs, and that the US government would make no change in its basic policy in Palestine without full and prior consultation with both Jews and Arabs. However, privately, Roosevelt wanted Ibn Saud to use his position with other Arab leaders to win support for a plan to transfer a portion of Palestine west of the Jordan River to the Jews as a new homeland for $50 million. In 1943, Roosevelt sent a secret emissary to Riyadh to ask the king to meet Jewish leaders to discuss the plan. After the death of Roosevelt in early 1945, his successor, President Truman, only 2 months after meeting with Ibn Saud, publicly backed the creation of Israel at the UN. In 1950, Ibn Saud asked Truman for a formal military treaty. In response, Truman sent his Assistant Secretary of State to Saudi Arabia to establish a military aid program that continues to this day. The king was told that the United States will take most immediate action at any time that the integrity and independence of Saudi Arabia is threatened. The king, evidently pleased, closed the meeting by saying he wished it to be understood that he considered the United States and Saudi Arabia as one state. By 1967, American and Israeli ties were closer than before, and a regional perception prevailed of the kingdom as being dependent on the United States. Arab sentiment against America spilled over into criticism of the ruling family. During the 1967 Arab-Israeli War, anti-US and Israeli demonstrations broke out in Saudi Arabia, publicly pressuring King Faisal bin Abdulaziz to temporarily shut down Aramco's operations and shipments to the US and Britain. However, only 2 months later, the Saudi regime quickly moved to end the embargo, and Faisal personally insisted that the US stayed. After the 1967 war, Saudi ties to America continued to subject them to growing pressure from Muslims worldwide. Faisal, hoping to resolve or at least lessen these tensions, ensured that he was continually seen to urge the Americans to press Israel, even though it was only to withdraw to the pre-war lines. However, the Saudi-America relationship only worked one way, and America developed an even more pro-Israeli policy, supplying them with arms during the 1973 Arab-Israeli War. In the 1973 Arab-Israeli War, the Saudis again, under overwhelmingly public pressure, withdrew oil from the market. The contradictions of the Saudi-American relationship reached its peak in the mid-1970s, when high officials in Washington openly threatened for the first, but not last time, the possibility of seizing the Gulf oil fields. Even though it was only a 2-month suspension of all oil supplies to the United States, it was enough to cause a swift and disruptive effect on America's domestic life and economy. As a result, the Saudis, not wishing to harm their master, never again brandished the oil weapon in subsequent crises. In return for the Saudis' deliberate ineffectual opposition to Israel, America's continuously promised the family protection as rulers of Saudi Arabia. The value of American arms sales to Saudi Arabia over the past half century approaches $100 billion, with over a quarter of the contracts signed in the 1990s. These figures include weapons, support equipment, spare parts, support services, and construction. Essentially, however, although they have been purchased by the Saudis, they are used by the Americans. The initial entry of the American armed forces in the kingdom occurred at the end of the Second World War, when the United States built a modern air base at Dahran near the Hassa oil fields. All the while, the Saudi rulers tried to keep the American military presence at low profile, aware that it was a provocation. And with this presence, little pockets of American life sprung up across the kingdom. However, arms sales, like that of so many to Muslim countries, were not without their conditions and limitations. President Carter's sale of advanced F-15 fighter aircraft in 1978 was only approved under conditions that limited their range and offensive power because of fears that they could tip the regional balance against Israel. Initially, President Reagan's sale of military equipment was only to help the Saudis guard against attacks on their oil installations. It included military aircraft, refueling tankers, and air-to-air missiles. When Israel raised strenuous objections to the sale, the packages were scaled down and special restrictions placed on the use of the aircraft. The ultimate act of dependency came in the 80s, when under American instruction the Saudis signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, effectively forswearing any nuclear ambitions. United States arms trade with Saudi Arabia increased dramatically throughout the 1990s. Of a total of $14.5 billion in contracts signed, $6.1 billion preceded the First Gulf War. American military presence also increased further.
These forces are participating in joint exercises with Saudi Arabia. Their presence will be temporary.
Before the launch of the Gulf War, Cheney declared, "After the danger is over, our forces will go home." But Western forces have remained in the kingdom, even in the absence of any formal agreement on their status. Instead, they informally established themselves under the pretext of the dual containment of Iran and Iraq, particularly enforcement of the no-fly zones. America had complete autonomy, often mounting large air raids from Prince Sultan Air Base upon Baghdad, without even providing prior notice to the Saudi government. Since then, they have treated the bases and the territory as their own. Subsequent armed packages worth tens of billions were designed to permit the rapid deployment of the United States ground forces from Saudi in the event of any Middle East hostilities that threaten American interests. These large arms sales and the Gulf Wars have also helped keep American defense contractors' production lines open, and have been quite significant for the US balance of trade. Nevertheless, the buying sprees of past decades have not lessened the kingdom's essential dependence on the United States for its defense and security. During the 2003 occupation of Iraq, Saudi Arabia secretly helped the United States, allowing operations from at least 3 air bases, permitting special forces to stage attacks from Saudi soil, and providing access to cheap fuel. Publicly, American and Saudi officials have portrayed the US military presence during the war as minimal and limited to Prince Sultan Air Base. In truth, the Air Command Center was in Saudi Arabia. Corrupt regimes plague the Muslim world, and like most other Muslim rulers, the Saudis have never had the interests of the people at heart. When not servicing the needs of their masters, their next most important concern has been to rob Arabia of its revenues. The Al Saud clan has lived in extreme luxury. Fahd alone boasted at least 12 royal palaces, ranging from the $2.5 billion Al Yamima Palace complex in Riyadh to a cottage 4 times the size of the White House in Marbella, Spain. He owns several jets and yachts, including one priced $60 million, all with gold bathrooms, and a fleet of Rolls Royces, Cadillacs and Mercedes. In the meantime, the income of the average Saudi citizen fell from $14,600 per annum in 1982 to $6,800, and unemployment among those who have already left school hovers around 25%. The gap between the tiny ruling minority and the people is stark. While one Saudi princess flies her hairdresser from Europe first class and pays him $5,000 a cut, in Hafr al-Batin, 50 kilometers from the Kuwaiti border, 60,000 people are living in shacks with no electricity, sewerage, and only minimal food. Saudi Arabia, one of the richest countries in the world resource-wise, now has foreign debts of $28 billion. And domestic debt has increased to $170 billion. Over the last 30 years, $3 trillion have been generated mostly by oil. Yet only $1 trillion have been reinvested into the country. The other $2 trillion remain unaccounted for. 4,000 or so Saud family princes get a base allowance of approximately $1.5 million per year. They supplement this with vast sums made through the following sophisticated forms of theft. Sale of oil. King Fahad, since 1975, has set up a system by which he and close members of his family sold on the open market in Rotterdam anywhere from 300,000 to 1 million barrels of oil a day at below market prices. Income from that oil was deposited in Swiss bank accounts. It is estimated that Fahad's annual income varied between $3 to $5 billion a year selling oil outside the commercial channels and oil company concessions. Real estate. Land in Saudi Arabia is owned by the government, and the government is controlled by the king with no accountability to anyone. Since 1975, land has been given to princes and their families by the government, only to be sold back to the government itself, thus creating the easiest means by which to rob the government of its resources. Contract fixing. Kickbacks on commercial and defense contracts is the third method used by the House of Saud to pilfer money. It is believed that every contract signed in Saudi Arabia has some form of kickback and commission. Large contracts such as the Al Yamama generated annual commissions in excess of $2 billion paid to only five people. Like a giant parasite, the US administration has also assisted in exhausting Saudi Arabia of its amassed financial reserves, totaling $121 billion. All this in less than a decade, and the Saudis now have to resort to establishing credit lines with the US government. This huge strain has been placed on the kingdom's banking system due to the fact that the 9,000 members of the royal family use these funds as their personal bank accounts, and most of these loans still remain uncollected. The National Commercial Bank remains drained, and one American official ironically called the unpaid loans the biggest black hole in the Saudi economy. The so-called caretakers of the Ummah wasted the wealth of the Ummah to finance worldwide CIA operations. As the New York Times reports, Washington relies on Riyadh for a host of favors, from discreet cajoling of its Arab neighbors to covert financing of CIA operations conducted through the CIA or the Pentagon, financing more than $1 billion to the CIA for its operations around the world. America's multinational corporations have also benefited greatly from the limitless spending of the Saudis. When America lured Saddam into Kuwait and then destroyed the infrastructure of both countries, it left the job of rebuilding and cleaning up in the hands of the multinational corporations. AT&T, for example, rebuilt the telephone lines of Kuwait and is now monopolizing it. The Gulf War cost America nothing, since the caretakers of the Haramain assumed most of the expense of the Gulf War. In other words, America had her cake and ate it too. The war cost the Saudis $55 billion.
King Abdullah worked closely with the late King Fahd in implementing the policies of Saudi Arabia, both external and internal. So I cannot imagine that there will be any particular change in that policy, but rather a continuation.
With Abdullah assuming the kingship in August 2005, the tempo of reform to appease the West may accelerate. And Prince Bandar's return from Washington, where he has been adroit at forging close personal ties with the US administration, suggests that warm relations with the US will continue.